All right. 1 Samuel chapter 17. Now, we've dealt with the preliminaries, how God orchestrated the circumstances. We call this providence, divine providence, how God orchestrated the circumstances. That here you have this shepherd boy who lives in Bethlehem. The capital of the country is not Jerusalem at this point. Jerusalem is still a Jebusite city, one of the holdouts of the original inhabitants of the land. Saul lives in a city called Gibeah, which would be about 6 or 7 miles north of Jerusalem. Bethlehem is 6 or 7 miles to the south of Jerusalem. And so remember, transportation, travel is all by foot or riding a donkey, which isn't super fast. You know, donkey's moving about as fast as you are. It's just you don't have to be moving, swinging your own legs. And, so people, for the most part, other than, pilgrimage to the tabernacle and so on, spent the vast majority of their lives within a mile or two of home. They didn't go any further than that. And, so here you've got this shepherd boy from the, environs of Bethlehem. You have, Saul, 12, 13, 14 miles to the north. And how is God going to get this shepherd boy up to and involved in a position where he eventually will transition into being the king that God has anointed him to be? And we saw that the Spirit of God had abandoned Saul, that Saul was troubled by evidently a demon, and they sought for a court musician to ease Saul's anxieties. And somebody had heard through the grapevine or somebody that there's this kid down here in Bethlehem that's just an amazing musician. He's out there playing to the sheep. And so they went and got him, and he became the court musician. And a relationship has been established, we'll see in a little bit, between Jonathan and David. Now, we often envision a big brother, younger brother situation. If the numbers are right in the book of 1 Samuel, Jonathan was easily old enough to be David's father. The relationship was not quite as equitable as we like to think it to be. But here we've got a challenge. Now, God had given, during the time of Samuel's judgeship, victory over the Philistines. Didn't wipe them out or anything. They're still a people to be reckoned with, but Israelites had had victory. You do not have a hard and fast border between the Philistines and the Israelites. There's not a major land, a row of mountains or a river or anything that separates those two places. It sort of one grades into the other, and when they bump into each other, who's going to be in control? Who's going to be getting the tax money? Who's going to be paying tribute? Who's going to be in charge? And so you end up with conflict and so on. And when the Philistines are stronger, of course, they subject the Israelites. And we have one of the first Bible stories, historic accounts that we hear as children growing up. I remember my father, my grandmother reading this to me when I was a little guy, of David and Goliath. And it's kind of interesting. Goliath is a Philistine word, and yet it's become part of the English vernacular, that if we talk about something being Goliath, we think of something that is just enormous and often having negative connotations, but something that is just huge. And so it says the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle and were gathered together at Shoko, which belongeth to Judah. So they have made an invasion to the east. The Philistines are there along the coast. The Gaza Strip that exists today was part of the Philistine territory, Gaza being one of the five major Philistine cities. And by the way, Palestine is a Latinization of the word Philistine. The Palestinians are not strictly Philistines. The Palestinians are an eclectic people. They're a blend of various Arab tribes. They would include, probably, if you could prove it, Edomite, Ammonite, Moabite, Egyptian, Arab, just a blend of these things, because when Islam came in, it homogenized the people. A lot of the tribal distinctions went away. There's still some tribal distinctions, but a lot of that went away. But you have this conflict going on. they've pitched their battles and or they've got their armies pitched across from each other, facing north and south. The river there, the stream bed actually, it doesn't have water in it most of the year, runs east west as all the rivers in Israel do except for the Jordan. And so they're facing one another, and the Philistines probably to the south and Israel to the north. And it says in verse 3, the Philistines stood on a mountain. Now, mountain is not like Mount Rainier. Mountain is more like South Hill. Stood on a mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other, and there was a valley between them, the Valley of Elah. And of course, where you have a ravine during the rainy season, you'll have water running in the stream bed, so you'll have bare rocks and so on, worn smooth from the flow of the water. But during most of the year, and during the time that the kings would go out to war, was always in the summertime. You think, man, wouldn't it be hot? Yes, it would be hot, but the ground is hard. You know what it's like around here in the wintertime. Can you imagine going out there with great armies traipsing across the Puyallup Valley? The first ones can manage to get through. The guys who are 10 back are up to their knees in the mud. In Israel, it wasn't quite that bad. My backyard turns into chocolate pudding with a layer of sod on top of it in the wintertime here. But it could get rough in places in Israel. By the way, when you read about the Battle of Deborah and Barak in the book of Judges, and where they defeated Sisera and the Canaanites had chariots of iron and so on. It isn't until you read the Song of Deborah that you found out how God worked that all out. Chariots only work when the ground is hard, and a rain came, and the Kishon River that flows through that valley flooded, and the chariots were bogged down, and the Canaanites couldn't use them. And therefore, the Israelites, they had to abandon their chariots, and the Israelites were able to win the battle through divine providence. Again, God working out the circumstances, controlling the weather to bring about an Israelite victory. So you have these two armies facing one another, north and south, across a dry stream bed. And it says in verse 4, there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath. Again, one of the five chief cities of the Philistines, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. And if you're using the standard measurement of the time, we're talking about a guy who was about 9'6", which would be taller than anybody that has existed in historic times. The tallest fellow that's lived in the last 150, 200 years was Robert Waldlow, who was 8'11". And it says in verse 5 that he had 126 pounds of armor. The iron head of his spear weighed 15 pounds, and his spear was like a weaver's beam. In other words, he had a shaft of about this big around, and it would have been about 7 or 8 feet long, at least. And so he had this gigantic spear, and very intimidating. Now, a guy that big isn't necessarily quick, but he didn't have to be quick. He just has to be big, and all he has to do is get you once. And you know, a bear doesn't have to be agile. All he has to do is get you once. And that's what we have here, is basically a human bear. He's well-armed and from head to toe. And it says in verse 8, he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel and said, Why have you come out to set your battle in array? Am I not a Philistine, you servants of Saul? Choose you a man for you and let him come down to me. And if he be able to fight with me and to kill me, then we will be your servants. And if I prevail against him and kill him, then ye will be your servants. And he did this for over a month. Now, this idea of having a conflict settled by one-on-one combat was not unusual. If you're looking at it from a strictly practical standpoint, it's a lot cheaper. There's a lot less loss of life. Let's just, you know, of course they could go out there. Let's just flip a coin. This was something the Greeks did. There was a number of others. Remember, the Philistines are not a native people of that area. The Philistines came from Crete. As far as their culture and so on, they are not a Canaanite people. They're a little different than the rest of the folks there. And so we have this situation and the battle drawing near, and you have the Philistines and this challenge that goes out. And you have Israel being led by Saul. Now, Saul at this time, remember, God has abandoned him. He is a, he's worried about his job. He is a jealous guy. He's capable, but God has abandoned him. And as we have mentioned before in the evenings, dealing with Ephesians and so on, there is nothing worse than a Christian can do, than a believer can do. And I'm not going to debate whether Saul was a believer or not. I'm inclined to think he was, but that's just my opinion. But there's nothing worse that than a believer can do is to be out of fellowship with God and then have to make major decisions. Because you are not led by the Spirit. You're being led by the flesh. And more likely than not, you are going to make a wrong choice as you are not being led by the Word of God. You don't have the spiritual insights and so on to the Word of God because you're out of fellowship with God. You have quenched the Spirit. You are grieving the Holy Spirit. And so believers do stupid stuff when they're out of fellowship with God. I was talking to my brother, several years ago. We knew a Christian fellow that did something tragically stupid and wicked. And, my brother, I said, how in the world? He says, hey, sin makes us stupid. And it does. Sin makes us stupid. People do the dumbest stuff if you were to sit down and say, you know, if I do this thing that I'm contemplating, that I'm being tempted to do, these are the various consequences that I will suffer. And what perks do I get? I might get this one, but it's not going to last very long. And I'm going to get this one, maybe. But I have all these negatives, and most of these negatives are lasting. But I really want this. But if I do it, then I've got to deal with this. What shall I decide to do? People don't operate that way. People act, they pursue the stupid. Because sin makes us stupid. And so Saul, in a lot of ways, has pursued this course. He is doing foolish things. But being a politician, he is being crafty about it. And he covers up his foolishness to some extent, although, of course, we have the revelation here to find out what was going on behind the scenes. And so you have this guy rejected of God. He has no direction from God, and he's become a cowardly pragmatist. Here he is listening to this going, and every time this Philistine comes out, you can imagine everybody does this and looks at Saul. Because remember, Saul is a head taller than everybody else in Israel. Saul is probably over 7 feet tall. He's a huge man. He's not as big as this fellow across the valley. But he is the warrior. He's the guy. We want a king to lead us to battle. Here comes the Philistine. Send me a man. We will fight. And there's Saul standing in his armor, not moving, because he's not dumb enough to go fight this guy. But he is the man that everybody would expect to go fight the Philistine. But he's not going to do it. And every time that Philistine comes out, every time Goliath comes out, he's shaming Saul. He's also shaming Israel. This is the covenant people of God. And then we've got David. David is the teenage boy. At this time, again, a little bit of time has gone by, and I would hazard a guess and say he's probably 17, 18 years old at this time, maybe even 19 or 20. He's a younger guy. He's not old enough to be part of the regular army. But he's a younger guy, but he's, you know, he's got some meat on his bones at this point. He has been relatively newly, and secretly anointed king. He's a shepherd boy. He's part-time court musician, part-time. Rest of the time, he's chasing sheep. And in this particular situation, he is a courier for his father. Look at verse 12. Now, David was the son of that Ephrathite, another name for Bethlehem, of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse. And he had 8 sons, and the man went for an old man in the days of Saul. In other words, David was the baby of the family. Dad was an old man at this point. And the 3 eldest sons of Jesse went and followed Saul to the battle. The 3 oldest guys are in the army. And Eliab, we see him a few times, never in a good light. Eliab, the firstborn, and next unto him is Abinadab, and the 3rd Shammah. And David was the youngest, and the three oldest followed Saul. David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And the Philistines drew near morning and evening and presented himself for 40 days. And Jesse said to David his son, take now for thy brethren an ephah of this parched corn and these three loaves, and run to the camp to thy brethren, and carry these ten cheeses, I don't like that, unto the captain of their thousand, and look how they brethren fare, and take their pledge. In other words, see how things are going. Now, this isn't going to be real far. This is going to be about 3, 4, 5 miles away. It's not nearly as far as going all the way up to Gibeah. But Jesse wants to find out what's going on. Plus, you didn't have, who fed the armies? Who provided their weapons?
The people.
You had to provide for yourself. And so he's sending provisions for his sons, because after all, over a month has gone by since they had been called to service. And so he wants news from the front. Now, there are two giants that David has to hurdle. He shows up, and he meets with his brothers. And it says in verse 23, and as he talked with them, his brothers, behold, there came out the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines, and spake according to the same words, and David heard them. This is the first David's heard about this. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. And the men of Israel said, have you seen that this man has come up? Surely to defy Israel is he to come up. And it shall be that the man that killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's free, or his father's house free in Israel, so they won't have to pay taxes. So, that's the bait on the hook. Saul's not going to go out there himself, but he's offering a handsome reward to whoever will. And so David hears the challenge, but he hasn't heard what the offer is. And so he asks. And David spake unto the men that stood by him, saying, not his brothers, of course, what shall be done to the man that kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Now, David is finding out what the perks are, but his chief issue is, who does this guy think he is? Challenging God's covenant people. I mean, after all, the Philistine ground there, that their whole nation is occupying part of the ground that God had promised to us. These are interlopers. That actually belongs to us by God's promise. And who are these people, these idolaters, who are challenging us? And so he starts asking around, what's the deal here? Well, Eliab is over here, the oldest brother. And he sees and hears what's going on. And it says in verse 28, and Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, why have you come down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and your naughtiness of heart. For you have come down that you might see the battle. That's why you're here. Now, David was there legitimately. His father had sent him. Why is Eliab responding this way? And for those of you who grew up in a home where you had siblings, especially if you're not the old, I'm the oldest. Now remember, this is an impressive guy. This is the guy that when Samuel said, surely the Lord's anointed is before me. Impressive guy. Big, handsome fella. And maybe he's jealous because he was there when David was crowned king, or was anointed king. Maybe he thought that he would be a better choice. But he lacks what David lacks. He lacks a zeal for the Lord. He lacks a trust in the Lord. He perhaps lacks courage, because we don't see Eliab volunteering to do this job, do we? We don't see Eliab all upset and saying, who is going to take care of this? And so David makes the inquiry. What does the slayer of the giant gain? He's taunting the armies of the living God. David has a legitimate reason from that. And so it says David turns from Eliab, which may or may not be wise, but he does that. And he continues to make his inquiry. Now, Saul hears of this. Saul hears about this. Word gets back to Saul. Hey, I know 40 days have gone by, but there's this, see this kid? Yeah, that kid over there. Now, Saul should have known this, should have known David, was probably at least familiar with him. I mean, in a court setting where you have the king, he's not going to be intimate with, he's not going to know real well those who are about him. He's just, oh, somebody's playing some music. That's lovely. He's not going to be interested. Hey, David, good to meet you. Now, who are you? And getting acquainted with the court musician. That's an American phenomenon. In a royal court, the underlings are underlings and they just do. You don't get to know them. And so you have word getting to Saul. And so Saul calls him. Now, remember, he's the rejected king. He's been abandoned by God. He's no longer empowered by the Spirit. He has no clear direction from the Lord. And he's cowardly and self-serving because he's not out there doing the job. In part, I think, because God had already told him through Samuel, you're done as far as king is concerned. You will not die a natural death. You're going to be yanked out of this position. And so he's thinking, there's my executioner across the valley. So he's going to do everything he can to keep himself from a dangerous situation. And so look at verse 33. And Saul said unto David, thou art not able. They come together and David had told him what he wanted to do. And Saul said to David, thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight against him, for thou art but a youth, and he is a man of war from his youth. He assesses David that he's inexperienced. But David's determined to go, so Saul says, okay. And verse 38 says, Saul armed David with his armor and put a helmet of brass upon his head and armed him with a coat of mail. And David girded his sword upon the armor and he essayed to go, for he had not proved it. In other words, I'm not used to, can you imagine? Here you got this shepherd boy. You know, he's jeans and a t-shirt kind of thing. And then he's loaded down with all this stuff and he's just, you know, with 40, 50, 60 pounds of stuff piled onto him. Now, granted, if somebody's going to shoot an arrow at him, off it goes. But he can't move. There's no offensive ability with David here. And if he's going to go against that Philistine, that big, huge spear is going to do a number on David, regardless of what he's wearing. And we know from later on, the Philistine also had a huge sword. David's armor against that Philistine, or Saul's armor against that Philistine is going to do nothing. It's just going to hinder David. And David was not used to such things, and so it says he takes off that armor. Now, let's see. Let me jump ahead here. I've got more pages in my notes than you do. And so he gets back into his normal shepherd outfit and says in verse 40, he took his staff in his hand, his walking stick, and he chose five smooth stones out of the brook, the dry creek bed at the bottom of the hill, and put them in his shepherd's bag. It's kind of like a small purse. It's got a strap around this side. He carries it over here on his hip. It's got a little satchel here, and he's got he might carry his lunch in it, you know, whatever he's got, and he puts those stones, probably about the size of ping pong balls or thereabouts, puts those in the pouch, and he runs down to meet the Philistine, and the Philistine came near and drew near unto David, verse 41, and the man that bare his shield went before him, so he gets to cheat. The Philistine's got his weapons in his hand, but he can't carry the, so he's got this big, huge guy carrying this gigantic rectangular shield walking in front of him carrying the shield. And of course, David doesn't have such a benefit. And when the Philistines looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy and fair, and of fair countenance. He had lighter brown hair than most. And the Philistine said unto David, am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? You coming at me with a stick? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. He's cussing out David. And the Philistine said to David, come to me and I'll give your flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. I'm going to make you into carrion. Then David said to the Philistine, thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. Now I want to pause here and for just a moment. Understand that we serve the same God that David served. And the God who is able to do what he's about to do here is also able to overcome obstacles that we face. We look at seemingly unsurmountable obstacles that are before us. How is God going to do this? How in the world can this happen? I mean, I've been working on this. I've been witnessing to so-and-so, and they get more and more belligerent every time I talk to them. I don't think they're ever going to get saved. Very often, if people get more and more belligerent, that's an indicator that God is working on their hearts. Okay, don't give up. Don't quit praying. Don't get discouraged. They may not get saved, but you never know. God is doing amazing things. And for those of you who got saved when you were older, you guys recognize the fact that, yeah, that was me. Yeah, I was just, okay. And we finally yielded, and God opened up our understanding, just boom. And we look at our circumstances. How in the world is this going to come all together? And yet God does it. We serve the same God. So here you've got this teenage boy coming against a guy who is higher, he's higher than the ceiling by about this much. He'd have to stoop to stand up to get in here. He couldn't stand up straight in this room. We got an 8.5-foot ceiling in here. And so David comes at him. And David says to the Philistine, thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. And this day the Lord will deliver thee into my hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee and give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day to the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Remember, the challenge is against the God of Israel. By the way, you go through the Old Testament, you see this over and over and over again. When any of the surrounding nations challenged Israel, saying, our God is more powerful than your God, regardless of the odds, who always won? Because God's name was at stake. It wasn't this slacker of a king who was on the throne. It's God's reputation that was at stake. And so David says, this is what's going to happen. And all this assembly, these huge crowds, this gigantic army that is standing on one side, the gigantic army on the other side, all this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. And it came to pass when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David, ready for hand-to-hand combat, David ran toward the army of the Philistines, and David put his hand in his bag and took thence a stone. Now, the sling has got two leather straps and a little pouch on the bottom of it. And he puts that rock in there, again, probably about yay big, and he starts doing this. Now, in ancient times, that was a serious weapon. How many of you ever played fast pitch baseball? Okay. How many of you ever been beaned? That hurts a lot. Okay, that's only coming at you, depending on, you know, how old you were, between 30 and maybe, I had a nephew that could probably pitch about 85 miles an hour. All right. That hurts. That leaves a nasty bruise or been hit by a line drive. I've had that happen. Got a nice black bruise, about perfectly round. can you imagine one of those stones, a stone, coming at you at, 180 miles an hour.
Stones break bones.
Yes. And so here comes David, and of course, empowered by God. And he puts, and he runs at the Philistines, and he starts going like this. And the it's kind of like, what's the goal of hockey? The goal in hockey is to try to injure the goalie in the only exposed piece of flesh he has. Okay. What is exposed with the Philistine? Part of his face so he can see. The rest of him is covered up. His fingers are exposed because he's got to be able to hold his weapon. They didn't have gauntlets like they did in the Middle Ages. But he's got something that covers the back of his hand, but his fingers are going to be free. And parts of his face so he can see. Not a big target. As big as this guy is, you know, he's covered with armor, and a stone might bounce off or may create a bruise if it was just the male armor. But he takes that stone, and I love, just me personally, I like the King James word here. It says in verse 49, David put his hand in his bag, and he took thence a stone, and he slang it. And he smote the Philistine in his forehead, right here. Right here. And it says the stone sunk into his forehead. Went right in. And he fell upon his face to the earth. Timber. Boom. The guy with the shield getting out of the way and running in the other direction. And David goes up there and I've got my sling, I've got my pouch, I've got four other rocks in here. He pulls out Goliath's own sword and decapitates him with it. And you can imagine the armies on both sides are doing this. Because this wasn't supposed to happen. The Philistines thought, this is going to be an interesting spectacle to watch. Our guy is going to slaughter this guy. And the Israelites are like, at least one of our guys is willing to go face this guy, but this is going to be so pathetic. And you had the exact opposite happen that was anticipated. And immediately what happened is the Philistines began to run west, and the Israelites came down across the valley and chased the Philistines. And the Philistines had to beat it as fast as they could. It says in verse 52, the men of Israel and the men of Judah rose and shouted and pursued the Philistines until you come to the valley that and to the gates of Ekron. In other words, they had to go all, that's another one of the chief cities. They had to come to a big walled city in order to escape. And the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way to Shearim, even unto Gath and to Ekron. In other words, the Israelites wiped out as many as they could on the way. And the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistines, and they spoiled their tents, they raided their camp, and took all the loot. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, and he put his armor in his tent. So he looted the Philistines. So he's got the Philistine's armor, he's got this Philistine sword. And we think that's pretty gruesome because he's carrying this guy's head in his hand. My Uncle Jimmy, when he was a boy, caught a big fish. He went on a fishing trip and he caught this big fish. But, you know, he was the oldest of four kids, family of six, so what'd they do with the fish? They ate it for dinner. Man, that was on a Saturday. And Jimmy wanted to be able to tell all his buddies about the fish that he'd caught. So you tell me what he did. He saved the head, and he carried it to school in his pocket. Hey, no, you didn't. That's just a fish toy. Let me show you. And he pulled out this, look at that. Wow. Okay, this is one of the reasons you know that David wasn't very old when this happened. Look at that. And it says in verse 55, and when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistine, he sees what happens. He said to Abner, the captain of the host. Abner is his is head of the army under Saul. Also a relative, I believe they were cousins. And he said unto Abner, the captain of the host, whose son is this youth? Now, he's a court musician. Again, remember, he's a servant. And also the inquiry is perhaps, is twofold. Number one, this is going to be my son-in-law. I've promised that whoever kills the Philistine can marry one of my, is going to marry one of my daughters. Now, that didn't happen for a little while yet. Saul pulls some things and it's delayed. But he's thinking, I don't want some rank poor commoner marrying into the royal family. I want to find out a little bit about this guy's family. Plus, what was another one of the rewards for killing Goliath? His family will be tax-free. So we got to make sure that this is arranged as well. So he sees what's happening, and he asks the question about David's family. It's because those are two arrangements that are going to have to be made. And I think the first one is the most important. In other words, this guy's going to be my son-in-law, and when we have the holidays, I hope that we don't have a bunch of, you know, hillbillies showing up, you know, this kind of thing. And Abner says, as thy soul liveth, O king, I cannot tell. I don't know. But he did the job. And the king said, inquire whose son this stripling is, this young kid. And as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine still in his hand. And Saul said unto him, whose son are you? And David answered and said, I am the son of thy servant Jesse the Bethlehemite. Now, we're going to see a change in circumstances very quickly, and we've got to call it quits here, but we're going to see a change in circumstances very quickly as far as David's status in conjunction with King Saul. But this is the working of God. Remember, God, we serve the same God. And when we look at insurmountable obstacles, when we look at a Goliath before us, do not be intimidated. Because our God is bigger and stronger and more powerful than anything that you're going to have to face. Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the promises. Thank you the fact that you are indeed the God of David. And you are the God of Elijah. And you are the God of the apostles. And Father, you can do and often do the same kind of thing today. Father, may we not be intimidated. May we not be fearful. May we not be an Eliab. May we not be a Saul. Father, may we be a David who puts our trust in you and does what is right regardless of the cost or potential cost. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.